In 1924, a new American law ended the wave of immigration to this country that had begun in the 19th century, where hundreds of thousands of Southern and Eastern European immigrants had entered the United States each year before the law. After 1924, those numbers were reduced to a trickle. Today's guest is the author of a remarkable history of the bigotry and sham science that lay at the heart of the Immigration Act of 1924. He's Daniel Okrent, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Daniel Okrent, whose distinguished career includes service as the first public editor of the New York Times, as well as stints as editor-at-large at Time, Inc., and managing editor of Life magazine. He's the author of six books, including the recently published The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
So let me just say, out of the gate, this is as impressive a body of work as I've read in some time, so congratulations on all fronts.
Thank you very much.
What led you to this story in particular?
My last book was a history of Prohibition. And one of the things I learned about Prohibition is that a big aspect of it was its anti-immigrant character. It was aimed by Methodist and Baptist ministers in the middle of the country against the Irish and Italian political machines that were taking over in the big city, and for whom alcohol was an intimate part of their lives. And just studying the anti-immigration feeling led me into this territory where I learned that the most restrictive immigration law in American history was passed because of a dependence on a non-science science called eugenics.
So for the folks who maybe only have a hazy recollection from school about what eugenics is, give us a working definition.
The simplest one, and I do use the word science advisedly, it's the science of planned breeding so as to produce better human beings. It's the belief that if you match two people, if there's a decision made for the purpose of having a better human being result in the offspring, that's the eugenics in practice.
It's breeding.
It is the same thing that happens with thoroughbred horses. It is precisely the same. In this particular case, though, it was applied to religious, racial, and ethnic groups. A rather different story.
What sort of amazed me in reading this book was the number of the great and the good in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Families that people would recognize, Rockefellers and Carnegies, major important Massachusetts families, Henry Cabot Lodge, others, presidents of Harvard and MIT and Princeton, who all get wrapped up in both the anti-immigrant aspect of it, but also in the eugenics piece of it.
Yeah, what they use, the anti-immigrant feeling comes first. Anti-immigrant feelings go back in the Republic, back to before the Republic. In the 1750s, a newspaper editor in Philadelphia wrote about how the Germans coming into the Pennsylvania colony were destroying it. That newspaper editor was Benjamin Franklin. And there were a series of laws. It goes in a cycle like a sine wave of when we are feeling anti-immigrant feeling is intense or when we're welcoming immigrants. In this particular case, the New England aristocracy was very strongly anti-immigrant at the end of the 19th century, not getting anywhere with it until they hooked up with the eugenicists. Then it was no longer a matter of prejudice. It's not that we dislike these people. They are provably, by science, not as good as we are. And that's what led to the passage of the law.
So why was the establishment anti-immigrant? I mean, they were the people in power. They had the wealth. They had the political influence in office. What was threatening to them about immigrants?
I think it's nothing more complicated, really, than the fact of the other. There's a description of Henry James coming back to Boston after having been living in Europe for 20 years and seeing the Italian immigrants on Boston Common, and he's horrified at it because who are these? This is something utterly different from the world I come from. They dress differently, they speak differently, they behave differently. There's also, I think, when the innate, I'm afraid this is inbred to all of us, the need to have somebody who's lesser than you are, the need to establish your own value in the universe by having somebody to look down on. So it was a combination of these things. And then there was the political aspect as well, because they obviously were a political threat to the aristocracy.
So we'll probably get into this later, but there's clearly an echo of that, what you just described in what is happening in this country today. But I had a question. I want to get back to eugenics, because it hasn't been well understood or studied by a lot of Americans. You said eugenics was applied. What do you mean by applied?
Well, applied science rather than laboratory science.
Yeah.
It was taking the laboratory science of what became known as genetics.
Yeah.
Eugenics predates the term genetics. Taking what was believed to have been learned in the laboratory, now let's apply it to actual, you know, the way that people live. And there are different aspects of it. There's the positive eugenics of, I want to marry somebody who is as smart and as beautiful as possible to have great kids. There are the negative eugenics, which is let's not let people who are deficient breed because they're only going to create more deficient people. And then there's the so-called scientific racism that was the national eugenics, in which it becomes policy to apply the principles of planned breeding to large populations.
So this was enacted through law?
Well, eugenics gets enacted in law in 32 states, starting in 1907, allowing states to sterilize the deficient. Now, the definition of the deficient was very, very broad, but the deficient who were under state control, in other words, living in state institutions, almshouses, prisons, homes for the insane.
Carrie Buck, for example.
Carrie Buck being the leading example, the lawsuit in 1928 that legalized it. So that aspect of eugenics, where the state could determine whether you could reproduce, that was put in place in law across the country.
Was there opposition to this amongst
To the eugenics movement, there was, for all sorts of obvious reasons, I think. But when the Supreme Court was asked to pass on it in Buck v. Bell in 1927, 1928, the vote was 8-1. An 8-1 majority said that the states could do this, and included in that majority were the great liberals, Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes, who wrote the decision in which he said, three generations of imbeciles is enough.
Wow. Shocking.
So there's the book recounts the history of anti-immigration efforts led by Henry Cabot Lodge in the period up to 1907. 1907, there's an effort to get a literacy law passed that's basically a requirement to pass a literacy test if you're going to become an immigrant to the United States.
A little bit earlier than that, but
okay. But when it fails in 1907,
it fails four times,
right,
Jim. It passes Congress in 1896, vetoed by Grover Cleveland. It passes Congress again in 1912, vetoed by William Howard Taft. Passes again in 1914, vetoed by Woodrow Wilson. Passes again in 1917, vetoed by Woodrow Wilson again, but then a veto override by Congress, because by then they had the eugenics to add to what they had already argued.
And so there was that moment I thought it was the 1907 effort that failed, that led the anti-immigration activists to then seek unholy alliance with the progenitors of eugenics.
It's a little bit later than that happened.
So
1907 is an important year because a big piece of legislation was stopped on the floor of Congress, and a commission was established. What do you do when you can't solve a problem? You create a commission.
Right.
But it came back to the floor of Congress in 1912.
The question I guess I'm trying to get at, though, is was the marriage between the anti-immigration activists and the eugenicists, if that's the right word, was that born of political failure, or was it born
I believe it
more
was.
Than that?
Well, I think that there were aspects, other aspects. that feeling of superiority. But the anti-immigration movement, which had been strong and successful in Congress for 20 years, wasn't getting anywhere. They kept getting vetoed, and they needed something to make it not seem that they were prejudiced, because that wasn't electorally a safe thing to do by then. There were a lot of people from these countries who were voting at that point. So by 1917, they picked up on the idea of eugenics based on a book written by a New York aristocrat named Madison Grant, in which he created a hierarchy of racial divisions among white people, among European-bred people, so that the top are the Nordics, who are tall and beautiful and blonde and brave and who made our country what it is. In between are the Alpines, and we need the Alpines because, you know, we need people, artisans and craftsmen. And at the bottom were the Mediterraneans, short, swarthy, and really not worth much of our attention except for their contributions to music. He actually wrote this. And in the book, he makes the eugenic argument that we know from science, he says, that the mating of any two racial groups, he considered them races, the children will revert to the lower one of the two groups. So the mating between a Nordic and an Alpine, he said, is an Alpine, between an Alpine and a Mediterranean is a Mediterranean, and the mating between any of the three European groups and a Jew yields a Jew. And this was the book published by Scribner's. The editor was the great Maxwell Perkins, editor of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, who continued to publish a number of the scientific racism books. And it provided the so-called intellectual basis for the final push toward the restrictive immigration laws.
But it was total BS. I mean, it was made up. This ranking of races and, you know, what you just described, was made up. There was no basis in real science, correct?
In 1921, an article appears in Good Housekeeping magazine that says that now that science has proven that these people, meaning the Eastern and Southern European immigrants, are inferior, we have to have legislation to keep them out.
Well,
that was written by Calvin Coolidge.
What made him think it had been proven? Who proved it? It certainly wasn't in a peer-reviewed publication.
No, not peer-reviewed. But as Jim points out, it was embraced by many important scientific institutions, the American Museum of Natural History, the Carnegie Institution of Washington. Most of the research was done at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, at Yale, at Princeton, some at Harvard, Stanford. The president of Stanford, David Starr Jordan, the man who founded Stanford, was one of the leading scientific advocates of it. These people had authority. They had the authority of position and the authority of background and of degrees and of influence that enabled them to turn national minds.
And of course, these are big names, big people, big institutions. And when you have that kind of stature and authority, the masses.
It also was a wide political range, from extreme right wingers like Madison Grant, whom I described, through really the core of the progressive movement, including such people as Margaret Sanger, a little bit later than this. But the financiers who backed the anti-immigration movement, they were the same people who had been the same families, same people who led the abolition movement, who fought for voting rights for blacks in the South, who created the founder of the Massachusetts Civic League, which does, you know, the good government group of all good government groups. These were all, we would think, forward-looking people, but they bought into this and they grabbed it and they ran with it.
And part of the appeal, I think, is the trappings of science. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if, in sort of writing this, you had opportunity to reflect on what is science.
This is, Jim, one of the troubling aspects of it for me. I mean, many things about that. I had these guys living in my head for 5 years. That was not fun.
And you're still saying.
And now here I am again. And I got them back in my head. So thanks for that.
We are very sorry. To talk about it.
But science only knows what it knows today. It does not know what it's going to know tomorrow. So if we go back to the early part of the 20th century, Gregor Mendel's famous paper on genetics was not discovered until 1900. The early geneticists they're kind of, you know, groping in the dark. The science that is being created suggests that these things that are happening with pea plants or with livestock or with thoroughbred horses, well, maybe that applies to humans as well. And they only knew what they knew, and there were very few scientific voices arguing against them at the time. The reason why this troubles me is I think about science today. I want to believe today's science.
Right.
I want to believe that climate science is the science that is right. How do we know? We don't really know, but let's not talk about climate science. Back then, they didn't really know. The leading scientific voice against the eugenicists was the great anthropologist Franz Boas, the father of American anthropology, and he was dismissed because he was Jewish. Well, of course he feels this way.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Daniel Okrent. Publishers Weekly calls him one of the most interesting and eclectic writers of nonfiction over the past 25 years. In a remarkable career beyond his own books, Dan has served as the first public editor at the New York Times and was also editor-at-large at Time, Inc. His newest book is remarkably researched and beautifully written. Titled The Guarded Gate, the book offers an incredible insight into the bigotry, sham science, and immigration debate of a century ago. He's on Twitter, too, at OKRENT.
Wow. So what about the Catholic Church? You mentioned specifically... Yeah. Italians and Irish, and certainly those are two groups that were highly Catholic, really throughout the United States, wherever they settled. Where was the Catholic Church on this?
Well, in fact, there's a division. The Irish were okay. The Irish were
okay. What do you mean the Irish
were
okay?
To the eugenicists, they were, if you'll excuse the expression, white. They had been here. They came from the British Isles. They spoke the same language. The point is, they already had votes. You know, Henry Cabot Lodge was from Massachusetts. The Irish were electing governors and mayors, and the vote meant a great
Kennedy
deal
was on the horizon.
The Kennedys were on their way. Italians were different. They were Mediterraneans. They were not, you know, even buddies to the Nordics. The Catholic Church was great on the issue. The Catholic Church was very much against eugenics and very much for immigration. The Pope in 1917, there's a papal encyclical that he publishes saying that the Bible tells us to take in the stranger. In the vote, the 8-1 vote on the Buck v. Bell at the Supreme Court, the one vote against it was Pierce Butler, a very right-wing, mossback conservative justice, but a Catholic. The idea to the Catholic Church of planning breeding, no, we don't do that. The Catholic Church, believing Catholics do not step in the way of God's plan, and eugenics was smack in the way of God's plan.
So, I'm early in the book, you discuss a poem, The Unguarded Gate, and the title of your book is The Guarded Gate. Is that a coincidence?
No. You've got to steal your titles from somewhere.
Yeah.
The Unguarded Gate was a poem that was recited on the floor of Congress over and over during every debate, written by Thomas Bailey Aldrich of Boston, a Boston aristocrat. And writer and editor, in which he said, you know, the unguarded, the hordes are outside our unguarded gates.
And was it a response to Emma Lazarus?
Yes, it was. I mean, it was not stated at the time, but it was an effective response. It was 12 years later, so there's a little bit of a gap. Yeah. But he invokes the Statue of Liberty in the poem, the great white goddess, he calls her, standing there. So that poem gets used by the anti-immigrationists. Because the gates were, they felt, unguarded, and my book is about how they came to be guarded. The law that passes in 1924 is in place for 41 years. 41 years where, just to indicate its effect, under the complicated formulae that were developed for the 1924 law, there had been as many, an average of 220,000 people coming from Italy every year in the years immediately before the passage of the law. After the law, the limit was 6,000.
Wow.
Decimation would be 22,000. This was beyond decimation. And the same applied to Jews, to Romanians, to Poles, to Russians. The worst of all were the Greeks, because the Greek, these numbers were based, this is very, it's complicated. These numbers were based on how many people from those countries were already here. But they didn't use the 1920 census for that, because all these Jews and Italians were already here. They used the 1890 census before they started coming.
Geez, that was convenient, huh?
Yeah. How did they get to that? So in the case of the Jews and the Italians, there had been some immigration from those countries. Not a lot, but there had been some. So their numbers, as bad as they were nothing like the Greeks. The Greek immigration doesn't begin until the early 20th century, when the Turks and the Greeks are at each other's throats, and there are economic problems in Greece, so that the Greek quota was 100 Greeks a year. Ask a Greek friend of yours when his or her family came here. It was before 1924.
So just very quickly, where were the eugenicists on Native Americans, the original inhabitants of this land, and African Americans? Where were they on each of those
populations? I'm laughing because the term that the anti-immigrationist aristocrat, Boston Brahmin aristocrats, used to describe themselves was Native Americans.
Come on, seriously? No,
absolutely. All of their texts, their
brochures. Jeez, did they know anything about
speeches,
Roger Williams? Or?
We are the Native Americans, they said. The Indians didn't exist. Somebody said of Henry Cabot Lodge, Lodge's idea of the West was Pittsfield.
which for our viewers is Western Massachusetts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not even into New York.
Elaborate that. The Indians did not figure. They don't come up. They are not mentioned in any of the debate, any of the literature of the period at all.
I want to say unbelievable, but it's not unbelievable.
But not unbelievable. Yeah. African-American, very different. Lodge was the leading congressional voice for guaranteeing the vote for freed blacks in the South. It was a real issue for him. He pursued it passionately, as many of these people did. But I believe that they saw African Americans as so much the other that it wasn't even a question. And certainly they're not coming over from Africa. Mm-hmm. When they put in the quotas, one African nation had a quota of one half a person a year.
How do you get one half a person? Top, bottom, left, right?
You try to connect with somebody from another African nation and get one.
This is the 1924 law is the result of decades of effort. Mm-hmm. It biases immigration towards Northern and Western Europe. Those are very white populations. Mm-hmm. Is this just white supremacy with a different name?
Yeah, it's white supremacy where there's a distinction made between whites. I'm not saying that that's any worse than the distinction we make between whites and people of other colors, but what it demonstrates to me is that the intensity of this feeling of need to feel superior and to need to have somebody else be inferior is so important to the human race, I think. It was not white enough if you were from Italy, or if you were from Spain, or if you were from Romania or Hungary. That wasn't white enough. That's not really white. And you see in the writings of Edward A. Ross, a sociologist who coined the term race suicide, you see him referring to certain groups like the Slavs as being almost white. He was later the president of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Did Hitler incorporate any of the ideas of the American eugenics?
He read Grant's book, The Passing of the Great Race, while he was in prison in Landsberg in 1923, 1924. Wow. He quotes him in speeches. In Mein Kampf, he doesn't address Grant, but he writes about immigration very specifically, that the one country who has figured this out is the United States, and we need to look at what they're doing.
But he wasn't talking about the melting pot. He was talking about the 1924 law that was excluding.
Right. He was talking about the only country that is understanding what to do about immigrants, keep them out, was the U.S.
We've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about today.
Okay.
Because I listened, reading the rhetoric, particularly the anti-immigration rhetoric pre-1907, in my mind echoed with a lot of the rhetoric that we hear today. Is this shared DNA, so to speak? Do you think that they're cognizant of?
Well, some are. Jeff Sessions, the late or former Attorney General, when he was merely a senator from Alabama, he gave an interview in 2015 and said that we need a law like the 1924 law. Very specifically, he knew what that law was designed to do and what it did do effectively until it was repealed in the 1960s. Whether our president is familiar with it, I guess he's not, but he's certainly using the same tropes, which is to say, it's one thing to say, let's cut immigration down to X a year. But when you are specifically identifying ethnic groups, Central Americans, Muslims from the Arab countries, that's exactly what we were doing in 1924, from 1924 to 1965. And we saw the consequences of that. the people who didn't make it from Europe between 1924 and 1965, and not just the slaughtered Jews, but the 300,000 Greeks who starved, the 200,000 Serbs who were killed by Nazi death squads, the desperate poverty in Italy. These people would have come. Many of them would have wanted to come, certainly, but they couldn't because of this law.
Do you think people who support immigration reform as outlined by the Trump administration see any link between those policies and the eugenics movement, or is this not even on the radar? I'm talking now average person who would support them.
I don't think so. But you know, if you go online to the places like Stormfront, the replacement theory people, they are here to, they will not replace us. They invoke eugenics. They reprint Grant's book. They hold these people up as heroes, and they look at the 1924 law, and the eugenic aspect of it is central to their belief. So certainly on the activist fringe, definitely.
Well, the activist fringe is one thing. I think about the day that Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president in 2015. He said very specifically, when Mexico sends their people to us, they don't send their best, which sounds remarkably like the argument from a century before.
Well, the century before said, don't send any of them. We don't want their best either. Although there were exceptions put into the law that let in MDs. My grandfather came from Romania in 1922, and where there had already been the first version of the restriction law, but he was a physician, so he was allowed in. There were exceptions. Now, it's the totality, when he refers to Central Americans as a group,
right,
or to Muslims as a group, not individual bad Central Americans or individual Central Americans we can't afford to have here, but Central Americans, period, while saying, let's have people come from Sweden, it's exactly the same.
We've got about a minute left here. How does, you talked about the sine wave of American history around this issue, does this fever eventually peter out? Is this a panic or?
It has always petered out in the past. That's the good news. The bad news is it always comes back.
Well, that's not very encouraging. We're always looking for a glimmer of hope.
There's a hope for you.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, the history shows that. There's absolutely no question that that's a true statement.
Yep. And, usually it's reaction. You know, something gets so extreme. And, I think many of us, I'm certainly hoping that this president will be replaced by a president who does not have any racial issues involving immigration and by a population that's supporting that view.
So very quickly, it's a great book, wonderfully researched and written. How long did it take to write it?
It was about a little bit over 5 years. Wow. The research, I get lost in the research. I spent 3.5 years researching before I put...
Down the rabbit hole, but it's fun going down that rabbit hole.
I love the rabbit hole.
Yes.
It's sitting at the keyboard that I hate. That's terrible.
Well, it's a phenomenal read and a remarkable accomplishment. Dan Okrent, the book is The Guarded Gate. You want to check it out. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. We can always catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square. We'll